This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Guest is a knife that cuts listeners into parts in a way those who know and love his work, those who might doubt his vision or expertise, and some who don't yet know him. John Michael Greer is more of a mystic than a scientist, you could say. He has a degree in the comparative history of ideas. He's published at least 18 books, now he tells me 20, and most of them were on magic and the occult. But we've called him today about two very different books, The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age, published in 2008, and The Ecotechnic Future, Envisioning a Post-Peak World, out just last fall. John Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, I've looked forward to talking with you, and it's strange because you and I approach some of the same problems with very different belief systems and come up with similar conclusions. Isn't life a strange place that way?
Very much so.
Well, as I was preparing to talk with you, I happened to read an article in the Canadian paper, The Globe and Mail, on February 14th, and it was titled, An Inevitable Collapse, At Least It's Not a Crash. And I immediately thought of a long-running debate in your work, years ahead of the time, I must say. Can you tell us how a long descent differs from the crash that everyone seems worried about?
Well, the crucial thing, I think, to understand is that our conceptions of our future are typically based on a set of narratives that most of us have not examined too closely. I mean, a lot of us have, I think probably all of us have stuck in our heads the notion of a sort of overnight Hollywood collapse where everything comes crashing down in flames, and of course there's a small band of plucky survivors, who end up becoming the leads in the movie, whatever it is. It's amazing how often that kind of thing dominates thinking about the future. Everybody wants to come up with the thing that is going to cause the collapse, and then, you know, they'll be among the plucky survivors who get the at least second-level billing and maybe a shot at an Oscar. In the real world, that's not how civilizations end. In the real world, civilizations wind down in a slow, ragged process of breakdown extending typically from 1 to 3 centuries, and which involves periods of contraction and crisis, interspersed with periods of even partial recovery, stabilization. It's a complex thing. Rome wasn't sacked in a day, if you want to put it that way. And one of the things that really motivated my book, The Long Descent, was and a number of other projects related to it, is an attempt to get across to people, look, we need to be aware of the difference between Hollywood and history, between the future that we may like to imagine and the future that we're likely to encounter.
Why would you presume that we won't find a way out, though, like a technical fix or a new energy source?
Okay. First of all, why would one presume that we will? Every civilization, other than ours, basically, every civilization has been through this kind of thing, in some cases many times. Go to China, you know, you look at the cycle of Chinese dynasties, there's, you know, a period of success and then a long period of collapse and contraction, and then another, they rise up and do it again. They've been through it like 5 times so far. This is part of the normal rhythm of civilization. And it seems, first of all, rather perhaps arrogant and, to my mind, even silly to think that we are somehow exempt from this cycle. Secondly, though, all of the signs that have been in the past indicating that other civilizations have been heading toward history's dumpster are present and accounted for in the present situation. We have overshot our ecological limits. We are rapidly drawing down the non-renewable resources on which our society depends. There's a lot of talk about how we're going to come up with some marvelous new thing, but that same talk has been in circulation since the 1950s, and the marvelous new things are nowhere to be seen. Sooner or later, we actually have to buckle down to the possibility the probability that Santa Claus is not going to leave a bright new energy source under our Christmas trees in time. I know this is another thing that flies in the face of our Hollywood narratives, but I suggest that at this point, it's the most likely future we face.
And this long descent, it seems like such a change from your previous work. What brought you to write it?
The interesting thing is that this is something that I've been interested in about as long as I've been interested in the esoteric spirituality that was my original major writing theme. It still is something I write about quite a bit. I got involved in esoteric spirituality. I got involved in the whole appropriate tech and alternative energy and futures movements, both in the 1970s. And with the coming of the Reagan era in the 1980s, you know, America's back. We don't have to worry about energy shortages anymore. The free market will conjure energy out of thin air. There were very few of us who maintained an interest in appropriate tech and things like that. I was one. But there was no market for that. Nobody was interested in hearing about it. So I mostly concentrated in developing my writing career and pursuing my studies, the other side of things. But I retained my interest the whole time in, okay, what are we going to do as the oil starts running short? Right out, well, when peak oil first started creeping back into the news right around the turn of the millennium, I started writing some essays for the Druid community at that point and saying, you know, this is something that may well shape our future. We need to start thinking about how our religious community, our spiritual community, is going to respond to this potentially very awkward future ahead of us. And quite unexpectedly, those essays and the blog that I ended up writing about the subject went from being a very small phenomenon in the Druid scene to a fairly widely read phenomenon in peak oil circles and future-oriented circles around the world, translated into several languages, this kind of stuff. So the books came out of that.
And as we know, the Internet enables some kindred thinkers to carry on working on current problems. And recently you called for the development of intentional communities to survive the coming collapse. And in a flash, bloggers like Sharon Astick and Rob Hopkins and Dmitry Orlov, they kicked in their take. What are your ideas on intentional communities?
That's a complicated question because that's certainly one approach, and it's certainly an approach that's worth exploring. But it's crucial to remember that a community is an organic thing. It's trying to make a community is a real challenge. It's a little like trying to manufacture a tree. And it's a community is something that has to grow. It's something that has to take shape according to its own dynamics. And a lot of the attempts to create intentional communities, as we saw in the wake of the 60s and more recently, a lot of those crash and burn because they run into the gap between what people's intentions are and how things actually work in the real world. I think it's still something very much exploring, but there are also other things like paying attention to the communities in which we already actually live that deserve a fair amount of attention.
Yeah, because I've got some experience in this myself. Back in the 80s, seven of us bought a 200-acre rundown farm, and we lived there for 10 years without electricity. It was wonderful. I got in touch with nature, but it was tough going.
Oh,
and,
it is.
You know, I'm doubtful many people could handle those changes. But maybe there won't be an alternative if governments and the economy start failing even more badly than they are now.
I would find it amazing if governments were to fail more badly than they're doing now. I mean, at this point, since really about 1980, every major government in the world, certainly that I can think of, has been devotedly making all the wrong choices. You'd think they were following a script. It's amazing.
Well, my general rule of thumb is if George Bush was for it, it's wrong.
Unfortunately, the same could be said of Clinton or Obama, or you know, or I'm sure there are equivalents in Canadian politics or anywhere. It's rather ironic that George W. Bush, with all of the hideous decisions and hideous mistakes that were made during his regime, his ranch in Crawford, Texas, is very green. He's got solar panels. He's got all that kind of stuff.
Amazing. Well, you also talk about the personal mobility made possible by cheap oil and how that has affected our inner identity. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, yeah. The thing is, we've been able to pretend that we're isolated individuals who don't need any kind of a root in the world, any kind of root in community, in place, because we can always just pick up and climb into our cars and go someplace else. That's been something that was made possible by the fact that we have so much energy sloshing about. As that winds down, that's going to be much less the case, and we're going to have to look at some serious changes in how we conceive of ourselves, thinking of, you know, the kind of me-first attitude that has pervaded industrial cultures for the last century, really, is going to have to give way again to a realization that the basic unit of human survival is the community. And if you're not willing to be there for your neighbors, they are not going to be there for you. And that may not be a recipe for a very long life.
And no Greer interview could be complete without a question on catabolic collapse. What do you mean by that?
Well, that was that's kind of the formal title of the model of decline and fall that I referred to earlier, the sort of slow, ragged decline that happens when a society is trying to survive against odds that it can't beat. It's catabolic. Catabolism is the process by which a body or anything else uses up its own reserves. And a catabolic collapse is a process of social contraction in which a society fighting for survival ends up burning through its own legacy. It uses its buildings for recycled, for raw materials. It scraps things. It burns things. Everything goes to short-term survival. And in the process, it makes its own long-term survival impossible. We're already well into that process now. My favorite current example of that are the number of libraries. They're basically scrapping every old book they've got. In some cases, there are college libraries that are scrapping all of their books. They're going for totally electronic resources, which means nothing from before about the 1990s. And so all of the heritage, all of the history, all of the ways of doing things that don't presuppose vast amounts of cheap energy are going away, because it's a cost-cutting measure, because it's a way of saving energy, saving money, saving resources right now that are going to cause massive problems further down the road.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with the mystic and social critic John Michael Greer. Usually EcoShock is a science-based show, but we humans do have an inner world, dreams, and beliefs beyond science. John Michael, how did your spiritual journey take you towards environmentalism?
Well, as a druid, nature is holy. That's probably the basic summary of modern druid spirituality. I should stress, first of all, that modern druids do not claim to be descended from the ancient Celtic druids. It would be nice, but the evidence simply isn't there. As far as we can tell, the modern druid community came into existence in the early 18th century as a response and in some ways a rejection of the Industrial Revolution. A lot of people saw what was going on, saw humanity turning its back on nature, and said, hold it, there's got to be a better way. It is not a large spiritual community, but it's kind of a colorful one. But at any rate, when you start from the assumption that, or you start from the basic presupposition that nature is sacred, that nature is the basic frame in which we live, from which we draw meaning, from which we draw our happiness, in which everything we do and everything we are is based, that puts you in a system of priorities where, goosing the gross national product another 2% by ravaging forests and dumping toxic chemicals into people's drinking water suddenly doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. And so you get a lot of what I suppose you'd have to call ecological attitudes out of that. One thing that the Druid movement, the Druid community, also very much tries to foster is a knowledge of the scientific dimension of nature. You get a lot of people in the Druid scene who have at least the basics of scientific ecology down cold. You get a lot of people who read very carefully in the natural sciences and things like that, and that's something that I rather enjoy doing also. And so it's very much part of the same picture of just an orientation towards something that is larger and deeper than the quarterly profits of the human economy, and something that relates to the natural world on which we depend moment by moment for our survival.
Have you seen the movie Avatar?
I haven't yet.
I think you might like it.
I've been told that by a number of people. I'm not a great movie fan as it goes, and of course I read several of the novels on which it was pretty transparently based. Ursula Le Guin's The Word for World is Forest comes to mind, for example. There are not a lot of movie theaters in the small town where I live, but when Avatar wanders over, I may make some time for it.
We face the frightening possibilities of peak oil or social unrest, a climate shift, or even an extinction event. Do you see a coming new religion or more spirituality as people try to deal with the confusion and fear?
Well, that's almost inevitable whenever a civilization goes into decline. When a civilization is expanding, when you've got plenty of energy, plenty of wealth, all kinds of abundance sloshing around, people can afford to, or think they can afford to, avoid the inner side of their own lives. But it's when societies start contracting that, the rubber really hits the road, and it becomes very clear that you can have all the stuff you want, and it doesn't actually make that big of a difference in your life. I forget who it was that pointed out that salvation is perhaps the one actually infinitely renewable resource. But a lot of historical writers who've studied the decline of civilizations have pointed out that periods of decline are the great seedbeds of religious movements, just as Christianity really took off during the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Buddhism was fostered very powerfully by the declines of empires in India and China, and so on. You can find many examples.
I'm worried that masses of undereducated people with their minds dumbed down by celebrity news will fall into a mysticism they don't understand instead of dealing with science and harsh reality. Isn't that a problem? And if so, are you part of that?
Well, they could equally, being just as dumbed down, fall into a science they don't understand. There is a religion of science. I figure any belief system that claims to know where the world came from and what happens when we die is a religion. And you get plenty of people of the Richard Dawkins variety and so on who claim to have all the answers. And they do it on the basis of science, and what they're promoting is, to my mind, a particularly bleak and boring religion. What I would point out, though, is that very often in history, perhaps not at the moment, but very often in history, science has been fostered by religious movements. It was as a result of Christian monks, for example, that we know most of what we know about Greek and Roman science. It was as a result of Muslim scholars, devout Muslim scholars in what we call the Dark Ages, and were actually the great ages of Arabic civilization, that huge amounts of other knowledge from the ancient world got through. Some very important scientific discoveries were made by these people. The same is true elsewhere in the world. I mean, Mayan astronomy, a calendar more accurate than the one we use today, was created by Mayan priests who were using it to predict the future by astrology. So this notion that science and religion are necessarily opposed to one another, and that science has accepting these hard scientific realities is a hope for salvation for our culture, where religion is this trap that we can fall into, it makes great propaganda. But it doesn't actually reflect what happens in the world, and I'm not really sure that it's a useful way of looking at things now.
All right, well, let's get back to peak oil a bit. And incidentally, I like what you just said, but I want to assume that energy gets more and more expensive, not just oil, but electricity too, and all that stuff hauled around the world becomes harder and possible to get. What should our listeners do to prepare for that?
Okay, the first thing that needs to be done is you need to take a hard look at the difference between what you need and what you want. Right now, in the industrial world, most of us have a list of needs, quote-unquote, which are actually simply wants. We can get by on much less than we have, and we need to learn how to do that. Partly that involves reinventing the household economy that most people used to derive a lot of their goods and services from. I mean, back not that long ago, of your average married couple, one member stayed home, one member went out to work. The person who stayed home was not sitting on her hind end, taking in soap operas. She was working. She was producing value. She was generating a lot of goods and services, a lot of real wealth outside the cash economy. At a time when the cash economy is going to bits because of severe financial mismanagement on the parts of governments, we need to start looking again at the reinvention of a household economy. That does not mean that it should necessarily be set up by gender as it was 50 or 100 years ago. It does mean we need to start looking at what we can do for ourselves, what we can do in our own communities, in our own homes, in our own backyards, because that's the stuff that economic fluctuations can't take away from us. We also need to look at what Rob Hopkins calls the great reskilling. Most of us don't know how to do anything useful. I mean, we're great at sitting at a desk with a keyboard or something doing stuff that doesn't actually produce anything of value. But people need to be in a position to produce things of value again for themselves and their friends and their communities. We need people who can brew good beer, for heaven's sakes. When it's no longer being shipped in semis, well, not that you get a lot of good beer that way anyway. There's a lot of things we need to be able to make and do for ourselves. We don't have to do it all for ourselves individually, but we need to be able to contribute to the reemergence of a community network of exchange that will produce a growing fraction of the goods and services we all need to get by. So those are some starter points. I mean, there's a lot more of where that came from, basically.
Well, yes, in your books, I would say. And before I forget, can you give listeners the address of your blog?
Okay, the blog is titled The Archdruid Report, and it's http://thearchdruidreport.blogspot.com.
Good enough. And, I'd like to pass the microphone over to you now. What would you like to talk about?
That's always a challenging question when somebody asks me at an interview. I would say the thing that I would like to talk about is the need to be aware that there is a middle ground between utopian fantasies of perfect future that we want delivered to our doorstep and horror tales of the ghastly future that we all, you know, want to think about quietly at night when we don't think we'll actually have to undergo it. Real history, real futures, real human social change happens day by day. It's not heaven and it's not hell. It is, you know, real life. And the world that we're facing it's going to have huge challenges. It's going to involve a lot of impoverishment of all of us in real terms. We are all going to have much less stuff. There will be a lot more challenges. There are going to be things that we can do and get and be now that will no longer be a possibility. That doesn't mean, you know, huddling in a cabin on the mountainside or blazing away at zombie hordes with automatic weapons or some silliness like that. We're facing a real future, not a Hollywood future. And I think if people can take the time to get their heads around that in itself will be a major step toward planning for the very challenging but potentially rewarding future that is actually ahead of us.
Can you tell us a little bit about your new book, The Ecotechnic Future?
Yeah, that was kind of the things I had wanted to say in The Long Descent and didn't realize it until the book was finished. The Long Descent was just talking about the basic process by which civilizations decline and fall, how we're following that, what we can expect to sort of run through there. The Ecotechnic Future, I got to work as that project wound down with, okay, what does this say about history? What does this say about who we are, about what we can expect in the future? What kind of world are we making by our choices right now? What can we do to change that? And so the Ecotechnic Future is an attempt on a broader level to say, what kind of world are we moving into in this process of decline? What kind of changes can we expect, with some reference to things like climate, ecological change, social change? What does a dark age look like? Because, you know, that's what we're talking about, the decline and fall of an empire and the coming of a dark age. And so it was described by the blurb writer as harrowing but ultimately hopeful, and I suppose that's not a bad description. It's also an attempt to talk about how we think about history and how we delude ourselves about the present and about the future, and kind of what that says about where we're headed and why and how. So it's a little bit more of a philosophical book. It is an attempt to set The Long Descent in its wider context.
Of course, if we pull ourselves out of a less meaningful and sort of plastic identity and discover new things about ourselves and our relations and our community, it might seem more like a light age than a dark age.
Well, that's true, except just be aware that for most of us, it's going to be these marvelous discoveries are going to be made while standing knee-deep in mud hoeing a field.
Okay.
You know, six days a week. It is important to remember that there are positive possibilities, but it's important not to get caught up in the sort of fantasy of, you know, carrying on a comfortable middle-class lifestyle in an age where that has gone away forever.
Our guest has been John Michael Greer, Grand Archdruid in America and author of two books on making the transition from the fossil age to a very different world. Check out The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industrial Age, and The Ecotechnic Future, Envisioning a Post-Peak World, both from New Society Publishers. John Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our background music is Open Up Your Eyes by Awake.